You're tuned to 103.5 WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro's 100-watt wonder, listener-supported community radio.
This is Psych Talk. I'm Jose Dras Lopez. Stay with us.
You're listening to Psych Talk.
If there's one thing neuroscientists agree about, it's that you are your brain. You're somehow the result of the electrical activity in that 3-pound hunk of flesh in your head. In this day and age, that's not a surprising thing to hear. But if you think about it, there isn't much in our everyday lives to confirm that we really do live in our heads. It seems like our minds could just as easily be in our hearts. That's what Aristotle thought. But there's one type of experience that really drives home how important our brains are. On this hour, we have two stories of brain injury and recovery. On the surface, these stories seem a little exotic, but don't be fooled. Unfortunately, brain injury is as easy as falling down a staircase. Every year, about 2 million people, just in the United States, have a knock to their head serious enough to disrupt normal functioning of the brain. Then, there are other ways the brain can be damaged, such as strokes and infections. But there's a flip side to all this gloom. Even though the brain is the most complicated organ in our bodies, and maybe the most complex of all machines, it has some ability to fix itself. Over months and years, it's able to reshape and remap itself to work around damaged areas. This reworking in the brain can make the difference between being in a coma and living a pretty normal life. In 1991, Dan Ramo was living with his wife and three daughters on the Gulf Coast of Mexico. He was the president of a local nonprofit organization. Dan will take it from here.
My wife and I, we did international development work. We had worked for years in Africa, South America. We were working in Mexico. In Africa, we had malaria. We've had tropical diseases from the work we've done, but the dengue fever was just really, really substantially worse than anything we had ever had. It's a mosquito-borne brain infection, very serious. The first indication you have that you have dengue is you start having these horrible, bloody nightmares. And then you develop a rash, you have a high spiking fever, you become delusional, you hallucinate, and so I contracted dengue, my wife and our two oldest daughters contracted it as well, all within 2 weeks of each other. And so, you know, my wife Susan and I, we were driving out of Mexico, and whoever wasn't hallucinating was driving.
They got across the border.
And then I took a big turn for the worse, and we knew something else was going on.
Because of his humanitarian work, Dan had a relationship with a CDC-affiliated hospital in Atlanta, so he knew where to go to get medical care.
And they called, and I was put on a flight. Susan put me in a cab and sent me off to the airport. And at that time, we didn't realize that that was the last time she was going to see the guy that she had actually married. By the time I got to the hospital, I was completely delusional. I was hallucinating. I couldn't speak. My teeth were chattering. Then I'm in the intensive care area where they had an isolated area because they weren't sure exactly what I had at the time. When you have dengue, when you're at the height of this fever, dengue is also called breakbone fever. And when the fever's spiking, you feel as if your joints are breaking, your bones are cracking. If anybody touches you, you're hypersensitive and it feels like you're being skinned. So I'm lying there on the hospital bed, and I think this person on my one side of me is hitting me with a hammer, and I thought she was torturing me for some reason, and I had no clue at all why she's doing this, and I'm telling her, I don't know anything. And then the person on the other side, my body on my other hand, I thought was skinning my hand. Later I found out the one was putting an IV in me, and my skin was so sensitive, I thought she was hitting me with a hammer. And the other nurse on the other side was trying to calm me down by rubbing my hand and just, you know, saying comforting words, but I was completely delusional at that time.
Then Dan got a spinal tap. The spinal tap gets at this transparent, salty fluid. It's the stuff your brain floats in, and it's the stuff where they could detect the infection he had. But spinal taps are painful. They involve sticking a needle between your lumbar vertebrae, and I mean sticking it straight in.
I felt like I was thrown out of my body up into the corner of the room, looking down on me from the back. And I saw them, you know, put the needle in, and when they pulled the needle back out of me, the sensation was I shot back in my body and out the other side, and I was just floating away. And then after a period of time, it was very peaceful. You know, the other side where I was just at was just chaotic. I was in a lot of pain. And then this side, it was just complete, utter peacefulness. And I was floating away in this darkness, like a Matrix kind of feel. And I got to a point and I heard a voice that said, you understand you're dying now. And I felt I was being given a choice with just continuing that floating away and dying or coming back. And at that moment, Susan and my kids were still just across the border from Mexico and Texas, and it just didn't feel right for me to die. So I started coming back, and I felt like I would get to a level and I would rest a little bit, and then I'd come back again and get to another level and rest. Then I could get to where I could hear things, and then I got to the point where I could start seeing lights and shapes and things, and then I came back to consciousness, and the nurses and doctors were all running around, and people were asking me, you know, do you know who you are? Do you know where you're at? And do you know who the president is? And I couldn't speak. I couldn't get my mouth to work. And so after the near-death experience, I spent, you know, time in the hospital in intensive care until they got me to the point where I could actually, you know, be released from the hospital. When I was released from the hospital, I wasn't the person that went in. I had a brain injury from the fever. The combination of the high fever and the near-death experience, I had a very dramatic personality shift. So I went from being a science-oriented person, I taught building technology in developing countries, to an artist within just one moment. I was so ill, I lost almost approximately like 10 years of my life recuperating from this. It took me quite a long time for my brain to heal. I would sleep, you know, 14, 18 hours every day for almost the first 3 years coming out of this. My days are just spent moving back and forth between this kind of a dream state and consciousness where these archetypal images, you know, just kind of pour out of me into the art. Even when I was doing the art, I struggled with, you know, what is this stuff? And I've had, you know, galleries tell me, you know, I show in a gallery and they'll say, this is fine art. And I'll show another gallery and they'll say, oh, this is outsider art. And then another gallery will say, this is what we call self-taught art. And it is all of those things. But it's only recently that I just decided that what I am going to call my art is biographic art. That I'm just a biographer that happens to use visual means, because that's what my brain is being triggered is into these visual images. It was my experience of the near-death experience, and then it was the experience of, you know, all the places we've lived, my healing through the period of time, all of that shows up in the art.
Thanks to Dan Rama for sharing that story, and thanks to Dr. Robert Rose for interviewing him. Dan recently co-authored a pictorial book with his biographical art called I Close My Eyes to See. Dan Rama is lucky to be a survivor. Most people who catch 3 strains of dengue fever at the same time don't make it. But for Dan, surviving was scary at first. For the first 3 years of recovery, he slept for most of the day and had such intense lucid dreams that he couldn't tell what was real. He asked his wife if he was a ghost. After 10 years, Dan reached his current functional state, but he's not the same as before. He went from being science-oriented, teaching building technology in developing countries, to being consumed by art. So did he recover? He regained his basic functionality, but he never returned to his old self. To his children, his new brain-injured self is their real dad. They were too young to remember the old one. In Dan's case, the question of identity stays in limbo. His brain had to rewire extensively, so he changed extensively. Other times, the question of whether a person has recovered has a clearer answer. That's coming up in our next story. In January 2010, Ryan Brady was a high school senior in Davidson, North Carolina. He was an avid pole vaulter. He'll take it from there.
Pole vaulting is like 95% mental, such a mental game. And I feel like that's why I was sort of naturally good at it, because I was able just to suck it up and run as fast as I could, you know, with this 15-foot stick in my hand towards this plant box that was gonna, you know, launch me up in there. I just had no fear. The day of my accident, it was January 9th, 2010. We had a big meet at Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina, because they have a really nice indoor track. It was our first meet, I was ready to go. UNC coach was gonna be there watching. I really wanted to impress him, so I was, you know, pumped up. See, sort of show me what you got type thing. You know, I had everything going for me and I had to perform well. So I get there in the morning. I stayed at a hotel in Chapel Hill the night before so we wouldn't have to drive up there early in the morning. When I got to the track, because my other teammates doing other events and my parents, my brother, my coach. I was playing my favorite song on my iPod. You know, I was really getting into the whole scene. I was really confident. I was almost more excited than nervous. I made the first few heights. I made 13.6, I made 14 feet, and this is going really well for me. And then, so we go up to 14.6, 14 feet, 6 inches. Most of the other competition is already out at this point, so it's like me and two other guys. So my confidence is just getting stronger and stronger. When you go up heights, you also have to move up sizes of the pole that you use. For instance, you'll get higher using a 14-foot pole rather than a 13-foot pole. I had cleared 14.6 in practice, but not in an official meet, so this was big. And I take my first jump, and I miss. I had poor technique. I knew what I had to fix, so I was gonna fix it. What happened in my second jump? Running full speed, I bend this pole, all of a sudden it just really loud noise, shatters in all these pieces, and I just fly into the mats uncontrollably. I have one more attempt, because in pole vaulting you get 3 tries on each height. So if I were to miss the height, I would be out. Then I wouldn't win the competition, and I wouldn't impress the UNC coach. And then I was thinking in my mind, you know, all paranoid, you know, like, and that means I'm not gonna get into college, I'm not gonna achieve my dreams, I'm not gonna, you know, be successful in life, you know, just those ridiculous things. I had a lot riding on this next jump. It's very important to me that I clear the bar. Even if I had poor technique, I was still gonna go for it. I'm running down the runway. I feel strong, I feel confident, but it's also a mix of nervousness. People are cheering, you know, like especially my parents. And, you know, I can feel the coach looking at me and, you know, in the back of my head. I go up to jump off the ground, playing my pole. The next thing that I remember was seeing these huge lights, the big ceiling lights hanging from the top of the track. They were really blurry at first, but then everything came back into focus. All the sound started rushing into my head, and it's sort of like how you get hit in the face with like a ball or something, and you get like, you feel like stunned for a second, you know? Your face feels sort of weird, and like there's sort of like ringing in your head for a second, but then everything just sort of like zip, like right back into normal. I'm laying on my back, and I'm in the plant box. I have no idea why I'm in the plant box. And the plant box, by the way, is a 3-foot by 1-foot steel box where you plant your pole. I remember thinking, you know, man, I just gotta get up. You know, I gotta finish this meet. I still have my third attempt to do. Why am I laying here on the ground? I gotta get up and I gotta go. There are people around me, my coach, my parents, other pole vaulters that were there, and they're all like yelling at me, Ryan, are you okay? Ryan, can you hear me? Just trying to communicate with me and I'm just really confused in my head. I'm like, what is going on? Everybody was panicking. Like, I could tell in their faces, they're like getting down in my face, talking really loudly. And I'm like, why are these people yelling at me? So the next thing I do is I try to respond. But for some reason, like, I couldn't say anything. I couldn't, I knew what I wanted to say in my head, but I couldn't say anything. So I was like, oh, that's fine. I'm just like sort of stunned right now. I don't really know what's going on. And so I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to get up. I tried to like move my legs or roll over, and I couldn't do that either. But at this point, I'm starting to become a little nervous. My mind is coming into focus as well, starting to put everything together. Can't move, I can't talk, and all of a sudden I see like the paramedics, the on-site EMTs are there, and they're rushing up to me. They're physically moving me around, and I can't do anything. I was just like trapped inside of my head with no communication to the outside world. It just sort of didn't really feel real. I couldn't move my eyes. Everyone around me is panicking. So something horrible must have happened. I also, at this point, I realized that my breathing was really bad. I felt like I was running out of oxygen really, really quickly. I felt like I was suffocating. I had already thought in my head, you know, like, I'm gonna be paralyzed the rest of my life. I'm going to not be able to walk ever again. It's funny how fast that your brain can think in times of panic, because as I was thinking, oh no, I'm not gonna be able to move, I also was thinking, you know, of all the things that in my life that I was going to change. I saw a picture in my head of me with my kids, and I was in a wheelchair, not being able to play basketball with my friends anymore. I just went through all these random possibilities in my head that was making me panic even more and more and more. I can easily say that as I was sitting there suffocating / imagining my future as a full body paralysis victim, I had never been so afraid in my life. That was the scariest moment that I've ever experienced. I truly, honestly felt like I was going to die. My life was over. There was nothing I could do about it. And it was just the worst feeling in the world. I even had paramedics around me, but they didn't know that I wasn't breathing, and I couldn't tell them that I wasn't breathing. And I was just going to sit here and die. So you know the expression about how like someone might say, oh man, I saw my life flash right before my eyes, you know? Well, when you think about that, like, you think about it as just like a phrase. At least I did. I always thought that that was just like a phrase you'd use when you say that you almost died. What I found out is that this actually happens for real. In those final seconds, my entire brain just sort of lit up. Every single memory that I've ever stored in my brain and every single thought about that memory that I've ever had, I saw my entire life as a whole. You know, not from like beginning to end or not in any sort of chronological order, not like a slideshow. My entire life in memory form as a single unit. It just felt like my brain was working so fast at that point. This happened once. It was not, you know, it wasn't something that was happening alongside all of my other panics. It was sort of like this little side room I went into and then came back. It was almost like a farewell, you know? This is everything you've done in your life. You can either be happy or glad about it. And we'll see you later. I don't remember specifically what all the memories were in my head, but the one thing that I do remember, I remember it giving me a feeling of peace, almost. You know, I remember being like, wow, taken aback. It was almost calming, sort of a break from all the panic. So they got me to the hospital, the UNC hospital, which is right next to the track. Conveniently, you know, I got really lucky in that aspect. Luckily, the paramedics, like, once they had got me up onto the stretcher, they put a breathing mask on me, so I no longer felt like I was suffocating. So that got rid of that problem of the dying problem. You know, I was like,
all right,
yeah,
that's
I was
down.
Like, okay, you know, maybe I'm not gonna die. No, but I've never considered myself before this to be afraid of death. When I think back to that, if that's what death is like, if that's what my death is going to be like, I do not want that. You know, I was 17 years old. So on the way to the hospital in the ambulance, my mom was there. She was in the ambulance with me. She was standing over me the whole time, talking to me, you know, trying to keep me calm, almost like she knew that I was panicking. I'm actually, you know, like really amazed at the type of strength that she had to keep herself in order during this whole thing, because I imagine it's probably almost more scary for her. So she was there, and my dad and my brother were following the car, and she was telling me, you know, just like encouraging stuff, like keep looking at me, you know, keep your eyes open, which of course I couldn't move my eyes or close them, but that's besides the point. Something to hold on to. But this was the moment I remember when I started being able to move my eyes. It was sometime during the ambulance ride, and she was there. The paramedic was, you know, like talking about me right in front of me. They're talking across, like over me to my mom, you know, like, we don't know how bad it is. You know, he's unresponsive. He can't hear you right now. He can't, you know, we don't know if his brain is working. And I'm hearing all of this. I'm just screaming in my head, you know, like, I am here. I can hear everything you are saying. Please, you know, like, I'm just begging myself to find some sort of gateway in my head so I can have some sort of communication. So then I remember I all of a sudden was able to move my eyes. I could move them right and left and up and down. And so my mom saw that and the paramedic saw that. And so they started communicating with me through my eyes. And, you know, they'd ask me yes or no questions. If you can hear me, look to your left. This made me more comfortable. I absolutely was not comfortable, but maybe more comfortable than I was, because I had this one method of communicating with the outside world. I was no longer solely trapped in my head, but I could answer yes or no questions with my eyes. So once I was able to move my eyes, then I could just like look at my mom the whole time. I just kept looking at my mom, and she was sort of my way of holding on. I didn't want her to go away. I didn't want to stop looking at her. Because it was a lot more comforting than being trapped inside my head with all these terrible thoughts. I don't remember what happened when I actually got to the hospital. I'm guessing that they, you know, gave me some pain medicine which knocked me out. And so the next thing I remember waking up in a hospital bed. I had a tube going down my throat and my lungs. It was a breathing tube. And I also had a tube going through my nose into my stomach to remove, you know, gases and whatnot from my stomach. So I remember just waking up and having, you know, like a mouthful of tubes. And I was still pretty out of it because I'm pretty sure that they had me on pain medicine. You know, so I was just sort of relaxing in this bed. I was like, you know, I wasn't really sure what was going on. I just wasn't really moving, just hanging out. But the thing is like in the early days of the hospital, I don't really remember that much. Probably in the next day, I remember I would wake up and all of a sudden I could move different parts of my body. So like I would wake up and I could move my fingertips and my toes. And then I would just pass out again and come back into consciousness and I could move something else. All to the point where after the very first day, I could move every part of my body if I wanted to, but I was so weak and sort of still stunned. I had like no motor control whatsoever or coordination or anything. And plus, I was wearing this huge neck brace. They were like rolling me and switching me to another bed. And they rolled me on my left shoulder. And at this point, I could like, I wasn't talking, but I could make grunts. I could make noises. And they rolled me on my left shoulder, on my left side. And I just had the awfulest pain, like the worst pain in my shoulder, in my collarbone. I was just like, not screaming, but I was grunting very loudly because I had a tube in my mouth. They did an x-ray and I had my collarbone had snapped in half and they didn't know it. And I was laying on my broken collarbone and that hurt pretty bad. So then I was in a sling. I remember my parents talking to me a lot. I could do thumbs up because they had like sit me up in the bed and I could do thumbs up. And so that was pretty much my main form of communication. I could like grunt or thumbs up, thumbs down for a few days. And so my parents had told me like what happened, you know, that I had missed the mats and I fell from about 15 feet and landed on my head in this steel box. There was no blood outside of my head. It was a closed head injury. All the blood was in the inside of my head. so yeah, I had the brain hemorrhaging. I had a skull fracture, which was more or less about 6 inches, going from the very base of my skull all the way around to behind my ear.
Your left ear?
My left ear, yes. I wasn't allowed, you know, to move my neck at all or my head. But I don't remember much from the hospital. From the first hospital. But I do remember being there and a neurosurgeon came into the room and he sat down right next to me. And by this time I was able to mouth words. He had this, you know, really deep intellectual talk with me about everything that had happened, how lucky I was to be sitting where I am. You know, he said that about half an inch down, and I would have hit my spine. Like I missed my spine by just about half an inch. And if I would have hit my spine right there, then I would, without a doubt, be in full body paralysis permanently. You know, so he had this huge talk with me, and at the end, he told me, he goes, "Ryan, it is my professional opinion that you never pole vault again." I didn't take to this so well, you know, because pole vaulting was my life and my dream was to do it in college and I knew that I was going to get right back out there and I didn't want anybody to stop me. So I was a little, you know, like upset that he had told me this. And I didn't want to believe it. And I was on pain medicine, so I said something that I probably wouldn't have said if I wasn't on pain medicine, which I remember vividly because, you know, it's a big hit in my family now of like how I talked back to this, you know, prestigious neurosurgeon. And so what I said was, "Do you have a wife?" And he just sort of like, you know, was taken aback by this sort of, at the time, random question. And he was like, "Well, yes, I do." And I said, "And do you love your wife?" And he said, well, you know, still very confused, "Well, yes, I do." Then I said, "What if something happened to you, some event happened to you where you completely recovered and then I sit down and I tell you that you're able to go back to loving, but you won't be able to love the same woman that you love right now?" he sort of looked at me and didn't say anything for a few seconds and then just goes, well, that's just my professional opinion. And he gets up and he leaves. And I was particularly proud of my medicine-induced response at that moment.
It's poetic.
Yeah. I must make it clear that I had a button like on my side as a remote control where if I pushed the button, it would release morphine into my drip. So here I was, and I had total control of how much like morphine I was giving myself. And of course I had like a governor on it, so I couldn't just like overload myself with morphine. But whenever they said, you know, whenever you feel like you need it, just push this button and you will receive morphine. So they came into the room and I was hanging out in my morphine / oxycodone, you know, sort of world I was in. And I had been sitting in that room for so long, you know, and you just get bored. They told me I was going to get an MRI. So I was excited because I get to leave the room, you know. So they wheel me down on the bed. I was laying down. And they go in the elevator. You know, I'm all friendly. I'm talking to the nurses and, you know, making stupid jokes and, you know, just being really outgoing, trying to make the best of my situation, you know. And I get to the MRI room and I guess normally they give you these headphones with like music because MRI is really, really loud and makes these really loud, annoying noises. And for some reason, I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but they asked me if I wanted the headphones with the music and I said no. I was like, no, I don't want them. I don't want the music. I don't want the headphones. I want to sit in the MRI machine all ears, you know. So I did this and I remember that these noises in the MRI machine, I felt like I was time traveling. I felt like I was going through a time portal the whole time because the noises are very, you know, have you ever been in an MRI? You know, it's like bow wow 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 wow, you know, and just these really like spacey type noises. I thought that I was time traveling. I was transferred to an inpatient rehab clinic in Charlotte. That's where I live. I wanted to be cool and I was like, oh, so you mean, is there a way I can get like the helicopter evac transfer? And they're like, no, we gotta do it just by normal paramedic. So I was a little bummed I didn't get to take the helicopter to Charlotte. So we get to the inpatient rehab clinic in Charlotte, and it's just this place where you can stay for however long, and you just go through intense therapy sessions, multiple ones a day. I met a lot of people there who were in much worse shape than I was. I really didn't like that place because it was just like a sad place. People there had chronic diseases that were there doing rehab stuff right next to me, and I didn't like realizing the fact of how messed up I was. You know, and being around people, being in the same institution as someone who I can like look at them and, you know, realize, you know, that they're really unfortunate. It felt bad for me to relate that to my own life, you know, or not bad, just uncomfortable. And so the types of things I did at this rehab clinic, we started with physical therapy. A normal day would be, I would wake up, man, they made us wake up at like 7:30 in the morning. You know, how is my brain supposed to, pretty sure I said this, I was like, how is my brain supposed to recover when I have to wake up at 7:30 in the morning, you know? Because this is in high school, so I'm, you know, really lazy teenager. I don't want to wake up early. And plus, you know, when your brain is trying to recover from, you know, trauma, it makes you sleep. Like, it doesn't give you a choice. Like, you just want to sleep all the time. And that's exactly what I wanted to do. But so they would make me, they'd force me to wake up. I wasn't able to put on my clothes because I didn't have like any motor like coordination. And so I'd have help putting on clothes, or I had to have someone physically give me a shower. Like I'd stand up in the shower and someone would, like a nurse would physically shower me, which is sort of awkward, you know. She had like a sponge, you know, I'm standing there naked in a shower. I'm 17 years old. This nurse is probably like in her 20s, you know. We're not that far away from the same age, and I'm cognizant of this, you know. So I can stand there and hold on to like a railing, and this nurse is just scrubbing me down like nothing. And I was like, well, this is sort of weird, but what am I going to do?
Was she attractive?
Well, right. That's sort of, you know, that's sort of like what I had imagined or hoped for, you know, that like there was this attractive nurse that was going to be scrubbing my naked body, you know. But to no avail.
We can leave it at that.
Yeah. You know, that was just a wishful thinking. So physical therapy was what we usually started with, and basically this was where I had to relearn how to literally walk. If you were to stand me up, I could maybe balance by myself, but taking a step was like trying to do a double backflip on the ground. You know, it just seemed impossible. And you ask yourself, you know, how do you forget how to walk? You know, you don't think about it ever. But I would take a step and I would just tumble over. I had no sense of balance. Balance made no sense to me. And so what we did was I had like a sort of leash type thing where I would try to walk down the hallway and the nurse would physically hold me up. And I would, we just repeated this over and over and over again. And at first I could only go like up and down the hallway, and then I get tired and want to go sleep. But we did this and we did like balance exercises, like trying to squat. They had me on a treadmill holding onto the railing and just stuff like that. And so over the course of like a week, I was able to walk very slowly down the hallway by myself. I got to wear a cool wristband given to me by the hospital that said fall risk on it. Kept that for a while, wore it around school my senior year when I went back to school. That was cool. I also took about 1 million cognitive tests a day. I'd have these sessions and these psychologists, you know, that worked there would just give me these tests, trying to probe my mind to see if there are any deficits, you know, like higher order thinking, ability to plan, ability to think ahead. And I did lots of math. I took like the equivalent of an SAT, all your standardized, you know, how messed up is your brain type tests. I remember I did a lot of memory tasks as well. They were really interested to see if my memory was messed up. The tests were a combination of pencil and paper, you know, and stuff on the computer, and just listening to things and repeating. They even checked my hearing. We did like hearing tests and whatnot. But all my cognitive abilities were fine. So there's a few things I would like to point out about the whole relearning how to walk experience. When I look at it now, I feel, you know, I actually feel fortunate that, you know, I don't want to say that I am glad that this whole event happened to me, but I at the same time wouldn't say that I wish it never had, because I have had experiences like through my recovery, such as relearning how to walk, that have definitely changed who I am today and how I look at the world. So for instance, the way I see it is that when we are a small age, we learn how to do things that are so basic to us. You know, we learn how to do the basic human functions, such as walking, such as eating. You know, you can't remember, when you think about it, how it was to learn how to walk. Here I was with the cognitive ability of a 17-year-old learning how to do something that a toddler does. It was so like beautiful almost. And I feel like us, you know, us humans are sort of robbed of these experiences because it happens when we're so young that we don't, you know, we only remember it. And for instance, I have this one really vivid memory of in Charlotte, they wheelchair me outside of the hospital. We went on a field trip, as they called it. And we went down across the street to this little riverside where there is a walking path. And the sun was out. It was a nice day. Of course, I couldn't feel temperature. This was one of the side effects I had from my hypothalamus being bruised. I had no temperature awareness. But that's beside the point. My nurse told me that my goal was to get up and walk on my own, you know, as far as I could down this path by the river. And this had been many days into my rehab, so, you know, I was getting good at this whole walking thing. And I stood up from the wheelchair. This was also one of the first times I was outside. Actually, the first time I was outside. I hadn't, you know, seen the light of day, besides through my window. And I just remember getting up and taking my first steps, like taking my first steps on completely on my own. It was just the most humbling experience. I was only supposed to walk like 10 or 20 feet, but I just kept going. I kept going as long as I could because it felt so amazing that I was actually walking, that I was actually propelling myself, that I was actually supporting myself, that I was transporting with my own legs. And I just remember how beautiful the day was, and it was just like, it was just such an amazing experience that I will never forget. It wasn't like, oh yeah, I remember this. It was like, wow, look at what I'm doing. Where I am now and what this whole event has left me with is something that, you know, I will value the rest of my life, something that I wouldn't want to give up. I feel like it has changed my outlook on the way I live, as in everything that happens around me, I'll take a minute to understand like why it is happening. Every environment I'm in, I will take a minute and just sort of soak up everything that's going around me. You know, I find beauty in the smallest things now. I remember one day walking out of my psychologist's office, I stopped on campus and I just looked across our quad and I saw, you know, these buildings, people walking around like little ants, you know, just walking around, going places, having things to do, interacting with people. We have created so much. We have accomplished so much in this world. I was looking at this building and I just started crying. I don't cry often, but I started crying just out of the sheer beauty of how, like, you know, complex it is for man to build this building. And I'm like, how did we build this? I put myself in what I like to call like a beginner's mind a lot, where I try to see things as if I've never seen it before, as if I'm not accustomed to what they are. I feel like I have been given this new ability to appreciate things so much more. Someone on the street could say, yeah, of course. You could ask them if they value their life. It's like, of course I do, you know? I value my life. But when you've been through the types of things I've been through, and when you've come so close to actually dying and actually feel like you are about to die. Even though verbally you have the same answer to that question, do you value your life? It's a lot different.
Thanks to Ryan Brady for sharing. That wraps up our two stories for this time, and thank you for listening to Psych Talk. We're in iTunes and on the Stitcher mobile app, so find us.